All right, welcome everyone. Thank you for attending session 156, John Pierce Holly and the Temple at Zodiac, Texas, 1849 to 1851. Please silence your cell phones. As you listen today, we invite you to explore what it means to be a part of the Restoration tradition. What does the history say? What does the theology say? At this conference, we encourage you to explore what it means to be associated with the Mormon movement. We ask you to reflect on your own Mormon interactions and to hold the good and the bad together to create a more full, complete personal narrative. In doing this, we allow others to do the same. A little bit about this session. It is 90 minutes long. We will do our part to keep things on time. Once Mel is done, there will be time for questions and answers. So be ready with your questions. He wants you to pepper them with really hard ones. This presentation will give an overview of temple development from Kirtland to Nauvoo to Zodiac and to the Endowment House. The center of the presentation will be a contextualization of Holly's insights into the changing of the endowment and other ordinances through those years. Mel Johnson is also the author of Polygamy on the Pridinales. I hope I said that right. I always mess it up. Lyman White's Mormon Villages in Antebellum, Texas, 1845 to 1858. And I bought the last hard copy at Sunstone a few years ago. So if you want one, you got to find it used online somewhere. And it's good. Buy it. You'll love it. Mel, a few more things about Mel. He has a Master of Arts in History and English from Stephen F. Austin State University. That's the Bionic University, if I remember right. He taught and retired from Angelina College in Texas, also Stephen F. Austin University, also Los Angeles Metropolitan College, the Republic of Korea. So ask him to speak a little Korean while he's here today. And, of course, the really super cool, awesome Utah State University. Served honorably in the United States Army. As I mentioned, he wrote Polygamy on the Pridinales, as well as the book he'll be addressing today, The Life and Times of John Pierce Holly, A Mormon Ulysses in the American West. He's authored a bunch of articles in the John Whitmer Journal. He's spoken at all sorts of Sunstones and John Whitmer and other wonderful things. We're honored to have him here. One of the very important things that he did, and he will address this more, is he was able to convince, after 15 years of working on it, the Mormon History Academy to accept the Zodiac Temple, Zodiac Texas Temple, as a Mormon-related temple. So he will tell us a bit about that as well. Thank you, Mel.
I am glad to see all of you here today. It's a great topic. I was minding my business almost 30 years ago down at Texas Forestry Museum, where I was putting together a database project on my primary expertise, which is southern mill towns and logging railroads. And I kept coming across these references to Mormon millers before the Civil War in the Central Texas High Country. Had no idea what that was. But about the 38th time I came across them, I opened up another database and started recording them. That ended up with the Polygamy on the Pridinales, as they would say it there. Pridinales is how we look at it here. And it took me quite a while to write it. Ended up winning a Smith Pettit Foundation Best Book of the Year Award for John Whitmer. Completely caught me off guard. But I was hooked on the intersection then of Mormon history and the American West. Will Bagley and I grew up with each other. We're each other's oldest friends, if not each other's best friend. We quarrel a lot. But he said something that has always stayed with me. You can't understand the Mormon Church if you don't understand the American West, and you certainly can't understand the American West if you don't understand the Mormon Church. Between 1847 and 1969, when the Golden Spike was driven, more than 500,000 crossed the plains and the mountains. One out of seven was some sort of Mormon. LDS, Wideite, Strangite. They were in Nebraska and Iowa and Minnesota, the lower Dakotas. They were in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. They owned California for 4 or 5 years, all the way from the Gold Strike lands to San Francisco and south. They were in Idaho and Wyoming and Montana. And it's a wonderful, rich history of the various denominations of the Latter-day Restoration. Most people get their history on Mormonism in the West from these sources. And you are the ones who do it the right way. You do it, you're reading, you do your writing, then you come to the conferences and you yell, you get books, and you get excited. Judy Nolte Lensink and Christine M. Kirkman wrote, the historian, well actually I wrote quoting, the historian Judy Nolte Lensink offers a cautionary note on the importance of heritage, our heritage. If we kill off the sound of our ancestors, she wrote, the major portion of us, all of us, that 'tis past is lost, and we become historically and spiritually thin, a mere shadow of who we were and are on the earth. And what is the key to the Latter-day Restoration? Temples and their rituals. I stole this from Patrick McKay. He wouldn't let me advertise the book on his website, so I told him I'd take this and give him credit. Notice how this is set up. We begin with Joseph Smith. Upon his death, Lyman White runs off to Wisconsin and then down to Texas. The main church follows Brigham Young, and from Brigham Young comes Alpheus Cutler in the Cutler Rites. Notice that up at the top, Sidney Rigdon's short-term church in Pittsburgh will morph into William Bickerton in the Church of Jesus Christ. We know Granville Hedrick and the Temple Lot bought the Temple Lot. Joseph Smith III and his historians spent 50 years saying we don't need temples and then built one, albeit for other purposes. James Strang, that exotic denomination most of you know nothing about other than that you've heard the name, in Wisconsin and Michigan, wanted to have a temple, had 6 acres dedicated for it, had the White River from the bathing pool to the mill house set aside for baptisms for the dead. William Marks was set aside as a recorder for those baptisms. And James Strang, wanting to be like Joseph Smith in all things, even talked about the day when they would have animal sacrifices in the temple. Those of you who are LDS, go back and look at a priesthood instruction in 1840 from Joseph Smith on the Joseph Smith Papers Project online, and you'll find his counsel that someday we're going to sacrifice Gumby. I'm doing it a little bit more than what he said, but it was going to be part of the rituals, which, thank heavens, neither the Strangites or the Brighamites, the LDS, ever did. And, of course, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints built a temple down between San Saba and San Angelo, I believe. It's been, 13 years since I got caught by security on their grounds and thrown off. They wouldn't let me inside it. comparative table of rites and rituals of early Latter-day temples. Kirtland, Nauvoo, pre-temple. And I only use pre-temple between 1840 and 1845 in the dedication of the temple because Chris Blythe from the Neil Maxwell Institute begged me not to use in the wilderness. He said, Mel, they had a town. They weren't in the wilderness. They were walking down to the river to baptize. So we're using pre-temple. Nauvoo itself, and then Zodiac. The concept of the church, of the chart, comes from Jennifer Mackley, attorney and great historian from Portland who wrote Wilfred Woodruff and the Development of Temple Doctrine. She doesn't have Zodiac in her stuff, and she doesn't have all the vertical lines, but she's getting there, and she wants to run this chart all the way up to 2020 next year and hopes to publish fully. MHA would not let us do our presentation this year because she's getting very close to the line of using language of the endowment. And I have been quarreling with the two people who said no ever since. At least we're still exchanging emails with each other without using vile words. And that's a narrow line, is it not, for you LDS who are faithful? And we're trying to recognize just where that line is and not offend souls. That's when I looked better. Life and Times of John Pierce Holly came out in March. Very well accepted. Sales have not been as high as we want, so I'm expecting you all to help out on that. Oh, what a good-looking guy 20 years ago. I am just east of Fredericksburg on the Schmidzinski farm, and Mr. Schmidzinski is a nice guy until too many Mormons show up at one time on his farm and wants to go look at the historic marker of where Zodiac was. Lyman White is buried 18 feet from that marker. The marker is in the middle of the old graveyard at Zodiac. His grandfather harrowed the graveyard under so there would not be a historic overlay. He's not one of my favorite people. It's on the banks of the Pedernales, spelled Pedernales. And it's a Paleolithic camping ground of peoples that, with the terrain, were able to make awls and needles and scrapers and spear points. And I must have gone through several dozen in the 4 or 5 minutes before Mr. Schmidzinski threw me and Bill Shepard off the bank. I was a criminal. I put several in my pocket. It is an amazingly beautiful place. Incredibly hot in the summer, beautiful in the fall and spring, and about 2,500 feet above Austin, which is about 60 miles away. And that day, we saw a herd of probably a dozen to 15 deer at 8 o'clock in the morning as the sun was coming up. It has not changed much. Spoiler alert. Want you to pay attention. We missed something, but that's okay. Schmidzinski Road coming off Highway 290. You can see how the river bends. Let's see if I can do this. I can. Graveyard is up here where the historic marker is.
Who placed the historic marker?
Pardon?
Who
the Historic Commission for the state of Texas. The town was above the banks, and well, it should have been. The floods off the Pedernales can be cruel. In 1851, washed out the arable land, and the colony moved 60 miles to the northeast to Marble Falls, where I lived for a number of years on Mormon Mill Road. How fortunate. This would have been the mill right down here where they were able to build a mill trace on the stream. This is a romantic recreation of what Zodiac looked like. Well, let's go back. The actual mill would have been up around here. This is the storehouse temple there. Kim Wells Greening, my dear friend, did this for me on commission. The original is about that size. It's the most amazing thing you've ever seen. Notice that she really strived for... Did it again. Accuracy. Every dwelling has an outhouse. And it would have been that way. What is interesting about this, I guarantee you that Zodiac did not look this clean during its time from 1847 to 1851. But it would have looked cleaner than Fort Martin Scott, a mile and a half up the river, and would have rivaled that of Fredericksburg, 3 miles upriver, which was a Texas-German colony. I like this because it gives a sense, of course, of Mormon mindfulness for order in the community. Traveling through Utah, looking at the old towns, you always know that town center is laid out. Turn right, you're going to go to the first church. Turn left, you're going to go to the first school. Go north, you're going to go to the first gas station. You know exactly where everything is going to be. And for historians, we like that. 1996, I'm minding my business in Layton, Utah, working on these things, and I get a letter in the mail from Bill Shepherd, Strangite High Priest, in Burlington, Berea, Wisconsin. Says, I hear that you're working on Lyman White. I have no idea who Bill Shepherd is. I have no idea how he found out it was Bitten Davis, the Lyman White scholar. And in it, he had a photostat copy of a Lyman White document, an attestation to the baptisms of the dead done in the Zodiac Temple, dated and filed in the Iowa State Archive. Knocked my socks off. Well, I was going out to my first John Whitmer Historical Association conference that fall in Missouri. What a fun time it was. I never knew there were other Mormons in LDS like me. Oh, I had heard about apostates. And Emma had run away. And I hadn't even known about Lyman White until several years earlier at the Texas Forestry Museum. So I went out there. I was going to give a paper. And I attended the Friday night convocation. And I'm sitting there watching RLDS then, Community of Christ Now, come to their feet and attack the first counselor of the presidency and the senior apostle of the 12 for talking about female ordination, changing the name, and other apostate designs that the leadership had upon the true and faithful. I am looking for a sergeant of arms. Could you imagine an LDS meeting where somebody stands up and starts shouting at the prophet? Nothing happened. It was wonderful. And the conversation continued. And then Lou Midgley from BYU got up and said what I considered to be the most important thing that Lou ever said. He says, "You all are defining yourself by what you're not. You're not Latter-day Saints. You're not polygamous. You're not this. You're not that. The only thing you're positive about is that you like coffee." He said, "You need to define yourself by what you are." Grant Murray, the RLDS historian sitting on the stand behind him, is going like that. And, of course, we all know what happens. 1996, I go over the archives, and I said to Ron Romig, who is one of the great and not recognized as well as he should be, names for inter-Mormonism back and forth of the last 25 years, I asked him, "What do you have on Lyman White in Zodiac?" He says, "You're the first guy who's asked that in forever." And he got up and he went around and I followed him. We went into this little alcove and there was an iron vault. And I'm thinking First Presidency vault. So it's got to be in the iron vault. But it wasn't. He reached up on top, removed three registers, pulled down an old one, blew off the dust, and handed it to me. And it was the administrative records of the Zodiac Temple, Texas. And I opened it up. John H. Young's handwriting, beautiful handwriting, after William Leyland, the scribe to White, died. And in there are endowments, married and single, baptisms for the dead, adoptions, so forth, so on. And he said, "Also, you should have this." And he comes back and he hands me the manuscript for John Pierce Holly's autobiography. I have no idea who John Pierce Holly is at all. And then I find out that Holly is also writing about Mountain Meadows Massacre. I'm on the phone, and it costs me money. And I said, "Will Bagley, do you know who John Holly is?" And Will said, "I don't have a clue." "Then I need to send you something." And I sent him the autobiography of Holly, where he discusses Mountain Meadows and nearly lost his life, or so Holly said, over the issue. Only 9 leaves are left from that register now. Baptisms for the dead in a folder. And you can see it if you go to Independence and the archives there. Somewhere there's a register floating around with 9 leaves removed from it. I have an idea who has it, and if I'm right, we'll never see it again.
What are the dates?
1849 to 1851. Selected examples. This is for endowment and proxy candidates for baptism for the dead and recorder and witnesses. And you can write Rachel Killebrew at the archives. She'll be glad to send you photocopies and scans of everything online. There's my guy, John Holly, married to Sylvia Johnson, sealed for time and eternity. And William Leyland, stepson to Bishop George Miller. And boy, did Leyland and his sisters hate the bishop with a passion. As soon as Miller got his wagon train down from winter quarters to Zodiac, Sophia Leyland Miller, his wife, plural wife, and William and his sisters all ran to Lyman White for sanctuary. She died, the mother died in their house that November William became an adopted son of Lyman White, beautiful penmanship, talks about his endowment in the Nauvoo Temple when he went with his stepfather, and about his own endowment in the Zodiac Temple. If any of you are interested in this, email me at melvincjohnson@gmail.com. That's easy enough to remember. I'll be glad to send you what I got. John is not aware, really, that William was endowed. I don't know why that is. I know John was on three missions out of Zodiac. It may have been gone when that happened. John also uses the term second endowment instead of second anointing, because when he's writing for an RLDS community. LDS, Strangite, Wideite, Cutlerite, Templeite, FLDS, all committed to temples or rites and rituals, endowments, except the Bickertonites. I wrote my friend Daniel P. Stone and said he was one who wrote that wonderful biography that MHA gave the Best Book Award to this year on William Bickerton. And I said, what about the Bickertonites and temples? Daniel was cute. He came back, what? No, they have nothing to do with temples, ordinances, or anything else. He says, we are the closest thing in Mormonism that you will get to an evangelical, hand-waving, foot-stomping Mormon congregation in the Mormon verse. He says, there's nobody else like us. D&C 38 says, for this cause I gave unto you a commandment that ye should go to the Ohio. And there I will give unto you my law, and there you shall be endowed with power from on high. And there you shall be endowed with power from on high, and from thence whosoever I will shall go forth among all nations. And it shall be told them what they shall do. For I have a great work laid up in store, for Israel shall be saved, and I will lead them whithersoever I will, and no power shall stay my hand. What is he talking about? Endowments? Temples? No, this is before the Kirtland Temple. He is talking about what? The gathering of Zion. And this is where the high priesthood comes forth, Lyman White being the first high priest, if you remember your history. And what are they endowed or gifted to do? Priesthood authority to do missionary work to gather Zion. 2 years later, we have a plat map of Jackson, where there are going to be 24 temples. Obviously, temples and ordinances are on Joseph's mind, and his understanding of the endowment evolves. I love Kirtland Temple. I spoke from the high priest pulpit with Danny Jorgensen in John Whitmer conferences. It is a most unique place. My theology is probably, we're all trying to get through this together to get home, but when I'm in Kirtland Temple, my soul swells and my heart grows warm. I love this by President Russell Nelson. In God's eternal plan, can you catch the voice and the tone and the mood from, in God's eternal plan, salvation is an individual matter. Exaltation is a family matter. Kirtland is personal. Nauvoo, Zodiac, and thereafter is family. I think I'll back it up. Kirtland, 1836. The temple is dedicated, and now we begin to see more ordinances. We see washings. We see washing of the feet. We see perfuming of the body. We have sacrament and communion. And then on the dedication day, we have great enthusiastic expressions of preaching in tongues, interpretation in tongues, the rushing of the Spirit, flames. Some claim to see angels. Lyman White claims to see the Son of God. What is this about? Once again, it's an endowment, a gift of power, not a passage, a power to do God's work. Brigham Young will argue later on that this is preliminary ordinances in the gospel of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, preparing for what? Nauvoo. And the development of the ordinance, of the endowment, excuse me. I love this plant, all the way from at the top of the temple, all the way from the beginning entry to the celestial room at the end, with all the side chambers dedicated to the various orders of the priesthood. But notice now, for those of you particularly who have gone through the LDS temple, that this has moved from personal to what? Family. And entering through the gates of heaven with the appropriate signs, tokens, and words to pass those sentinels for you to enter into the glory of God. Was I careful enough with the language there to not be offensive? I've worked on that sentence ever since we got booted out of MHA for consideration for our presentation. Denominations on the left, ordinances on the right. Who can give me a definition of ordinance? A basic definition. When you are presented with Sister Golden as to be the New Relief Society president in your ward, what do you all do? All of those who can approve of this manifest by raising the right hand. That is an ordinance. And it's a sealing. And it's a confirmation of power upon Sister Golden to be able to do the job that the Lord would want her to do. Expand your concept of ordinance. When someone lays her hands at home on another family member, and I know female members who do it for health, healing, inspiration, guidance, it's an ordinance. And it's asking for a confirmation. Notice these. Baptism for health and healing. Baptism for the dead. Living endowment for single and married. Proxy endowment, adoptions. Rebaptism for what? Repentance. For commitment to a calling. Prayer circles. Prayer circles begin in Kirtland, but they are not the prayer circles of the Holy Anointed in Nauvoo. These are prayer circles much like the ring circles. Boy, doesn't that sound spooky. Ring circles, they're really talking about Methodist Episcopal circles of the time when people would stand around in circles, raise their hands or hold hands, and pray to a common purpose. And that's what the prayer circles at Kirtland were. They were not the proto-endowment at Nauvoo, where it turns into something very different, where the anointed quorum is praying in the, what's the right term for it? Thank you, sir. Which has to do with the endowment. This will continue, the prayer circles, until somebody wrote an article in 1979 at BYU. Wonder who that could have been, Brother Quinn, that says until 1921, it was a common thing in LDS temples. And then I think it was Elder Witso who had to explain to the entire church body that we were not going to do this anymore. Second anointing or endowment. Is Brad Kramer here by any chance? I hoped he were. Brad wrote a wonderful dissertation on Alpheus Cutler's group in Iowa and Minnesota, and their continuing of the rituals from the Nauvoo Temple that is carried on to when? When did they stop? They haven't. There's still 12. And in Jackson, Independence, they still go upstairs regularly to hold their rites and ceremonies. Where are we in that 40-minute block?
It is 2:37.
We've got about 8 more minutes, and we'll open up to questions. Billy Young Whiting, Danny Whiting Jorgensen, Chris Blythe, and Richard E. Bennett, all whom I know and all whom I like, all quarrel about what the Cutlerites are still doing today. And they're confused amongst themselves. They're doing this. No, they're not. They're doing that. No, they're not. They're doing this. And if you ask them, there's only one man who really knows what they're doing. If she is telling Rick C. Bennett the truth. And Rick's pretty good at getting the truth out of people. What you need to understand is that the Cutlerites are still doing ordinances originating in the temple at Nauvoo long ago. It was John Whitmer, and I think we were at Florence, Winter Quarters. And there was this young LDS elder out there with Rick Bennett and a couple of the other LDS historian honchos, and he had finally come to the realization that the Cutlerites are old, they're dying, nobody's going to replace them, and he said, we need to get their rituals written down. And I looked at him, and I said, you're kidding. He said, no, we need to do this. I said, they're not going to tell you. And he said, well, then they're going to die out. I said, okay, let's go through this. Where does their rituals, endowments, and leadership come from? Angelic revelation and ordination. And if they die out and the angel comes again, he's not coming to you, young elder. He will come to the individual that he's appointed to come to. He was very disappointed that he was not going to be able to record those rituals. This is a Wideite mill. In this one, they cut lumber and grinded corn and wheat. Up at Marble Falls, I have stood on the shale of the falls. It's an amazingly quiet place. Let's go back. Oh, good heavens. That is the only large extent Wideite artifact left. It is the graveyard to the right of Mormon Mill Cemetery in Hamilton Creek. 14 Wideites are buried inside. 6 non-LDS are buried outside. And now we can go. We'll do this very quickly. I don't know how that got in there. I'm from East Texas, and it is unlike anything you Utahns have ever seen. When the rains come, Noah would be impressed. He'd go, "That looks familiar." To the right of that is the Sabine River. And what we've got is a creek that has jumped over its banks. And in East Texas, we work together when things happen. Notice the doggies swimming, leading the herd, and the man on horseback all the way in the back. That's very Mormonism, is it not? We do things together, do we not? Each in their way, each with their own responsibility. And when it works really well. And we have each seen when it doesn't work well at all. John Whitmer, historical conference will be down at St. George next year in September. You all need to come. It will be a hoot. I was at the meeting and somebody said, "Well, that's a boondoggle." And somebody said, "Yes, it's a boondoggle, but it's St. George." And everybody went, "But it's St. George." And I'm excited about it because I went to St. George Dixie College for my first year 50 years ago when it was a community college. That is where I changed from being a callow youth into realizing that I would become an academic, and they showed me how to do it. I love St. George, and I love Dixie College, and I'd love you all to come. And it's cheaper than here. This is about the length of my theology. Ram Dass's recreation, we are all just walking each other home. And that's about all I had to say, so let's have some questions. Who's got the first question? And how are we going
to
do this, brother?
Just move up to the mic and ask the question into the microphone. So,
who wants to get up on foot first? I love your pointer. Thank you.
Was the temple in Zodiac, Texas, begun while Lyman White was still an apostle in good standing in the Quorum of the Twelve?
That's a great question, and no, he was not. The question was Lyman White still in good standing with his brothers in the Quorum? No, he had been excommunicated 3 months before, and the temple was opened up in February 18th, 1849. Oh, when it was dedicated, would have been February 18th, 1849. They would have put up that storehouse temple within 3 weeks. No problem. They would have began in January, I would imagine. And that does not surprise me, because that leads me to the link. Two emissaries from Brigham Young had landed in Zodiac during Christmas and chewed out Lyman White. He chewed him back, and he said, "I'm not coming to Utah." That's interesting. Who else? Who's got a question? Claire Barris. I'm in trouble.
This is a softball, Mel. Zodiac, can you tell us why the term Zodiac and what cosmological significance that may have had?
Sure. Question is, the name is Zodiac, Texas. What cosmological significance does it have? Four letters beginning with N, ending with E. None. It comes from wild ram. Wild ram in the Zodiac. So they went with Zodiac. That's as deep as it gets.
And why wild ram? Is that whiskey, the wild ram?
Yeah, he was a wild ram from William Clayton's designation. Parley Pratt is the archer and all of that. And what are we doing with those names? Mormon myth-making. Making the leadership look good. Do we do that today? Does every other Latter-day Restoration group do something similar today? And I'm not picking on Mormonism. I can take you to all the evangelical congregations in town and show you similar things. It's what we do when we're together, are we not, in our various important groups and assemblies? We have leaders. We have people that have talents. And we like recognizing those, do we not? It binds us together. And that's what that was about. Who else? Oh, don't be shy. Don't make me stand up here looking silly. Well, then. John Pierce Holly, an amazing individual born in the frontier of Illinois, survived the 1832 Sauk and Fox War. At 13, he and his brothers are herding cattle and trying to keep them away from the Missourians during the Missouri Mormon Civil War. The Missourians were trying to kill his dad, who was on the Dodge. The Missourians caught him once, he and his brothers. And this was 14, 13, and 11. And here are these big men with their big horses and their firearms scaring the crap out of them. Are you Mormons? John Pierce Holly lied, said, no, we're not. Aaron, the 11-year-old, gave it away. Yes, we are. Don't shoot us. And the men let him go. And John said, it was the last time that I ever denied being Mormon. And in time since, when I was in danger, and believe me, in the aftermath of Mount Meadows Massacre, John was in danger of being killed by the priesthood leadership of Washington Ward, Robert Covington, and particularly his first counselor, Harrison Pierce. And John says, I don't care. You guys did wrong. And a vote was taken by the leadership, and by a narrow margin, John was allowed to live. Uncle Billy Young, a family member by marriage, not blood, came to him and said, you just dodged a bullet. Keep your mouth shut for a while. He went with White down to Texas from the Wisconsin pineries, the sawmills that were producing lumber and timber for the Nauvoo House, Nauvoo Temple, and the Nauvoo building boom. Helped build the temple. Was married twice in rites and rituals. His first wife, whom he married outside of Austin on the prairie, what I like to say in the wilderness, Chris Blythe's just shudders, ran away, disappeared with a bunch of others. And Lyman said, well, you're not married anymore, you're divorced. So when John married his life love, Sylvia, they would be married until 1909. They were married in 1849. They died within 3 weeks of each other in Iowa. Moved up to the Indian Nations when they left the Whiteites. There, Henry W. Miller of the Cherokee Indian Mission converted 35 former Whiteites, and they all gathered to Zion. And what was their reward? Sent to the Washington County Cotton Mission when it opened. John just about broke into tears when they got down there. His wife did. And that whole first summer in 1857, when the potatoes failed and the wheat failed and the corn almost failed and the cotton didn't make it out of the ground, they kept looking up at Pine Valley Mountain. Said that's the place to be. After the massacre, John and his brothers went up and got their wives from Provo, where they had been staying, went up to the endowment house, were sealed and married again, came down and moved up and opened Pine Valley with the other families. He was the presiding elder for 11 years at Pine Valley. That beautiful little chapel there in the valley was built under his and then later Bishop Snow's direction. In 1868, they organized Pine Valley into a ward, and John was the first counselor. The reason he did not become bishop was that Apostle Erastus Snow, director of the Southern Utah Mission, did not think monogamous men should be high priesthood leaders. John, that year, was called on a mission to his relatives in Iowa. And he went for 5 months, held his mother for the first time in 12 years, saw family and friends from Texas. He said, "I didn't convert anybody, but nobody converted me either." But questions were planted in his head. By the spring of 1870, he and his brother George, who no longer had plural wives, so it was not a barrier, were baptized into the RLDS Church. Jesse Embry, the editor of the Journal of Mormon History, with that wonderful opening essay on Josephites at the top of the mountains, the RLDS missions into Utah in the 1860s. They were part of that. So John goes down to Pine Valley Ward, preaches his final sermon to a very startled congregation. Erastus Snow comes up and curses him out, won't let him talk, won't let him respond. He says, "George, what do you have to say for yourself?" And George went and said nothing. Packed their families up, moved on up to the railhead in Salt Lake. They met Elder Snow on the way. Erastus says, "I've had a change of mind about you, John. When you are tired of stepping out of the kingdom, you're welcome back." And John basically said, "When you're done with Adam God and polygamy and a number of other things, I'll consider it." Never came back to Utah. Became an RLDS high priest, and 40 years as a missionary and priesthood leader in Iowa, Kansas, Indian Territory, later Oklahoma and Missouri, preached the gospel of the RLDS. And now I am done. Thank you very much.